Speaker who's speaking on spiritual, not religious, and that's Tony S. from the Frederick area.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tony, and I'm an addict. Please bear with me. I'm freaking out right now. Totally. It's not my first rodeo, but for some reason, I've had a lot of anxiety today as a result of this. I woke up this morning blessed to be alive. By the grace of God, I'm here with you all. And I can't say that enough. I'm a grateful addict, and for almost 19 years, I haven't had a need to use again. I'm very humble because it's nothing that I've ever done. It's all God, of my understanding. It's all you people in these rooms that's helped me. A few of them are here, my family from almost Heaven area and Frederick area are here too. I was reading this morning. I needed to get some perspective because where I'm at with I'm really nervous. Usually once, if my voice starts to get high, don't be freaked out, because once I get rolling sometimes, I tend to get a little loud. And I can do that, you know, because once I get comfortable and I get into it and all the barriers come down, and then I'm in my zone, you know. Because let me just say, my disease, it isolates me. It makes me feel unworthy. I can never do anything right, no matter what I do. I'm my worst enemy. I'm highly critical of everything I do. I remember growing up as a boy, how, I'm trying to stay on point here. Let me just get a point of reference to start from, and that's the topic. Spiritual, not religious. I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness. My mom took us to Bible study on Tuesdays, Bible studies on Thursdays. We had two what do we call them? Hell, I can't even remember. Two speakers on Sunday, and we had door-to-door service on Saturday. So if a Jehovah's Witness knocking on your door, it was probably me. Best thing I liked about it was actually getting dressed up and putting on a tie and going out. But when the door got slammed in your face, and then some of the same people I went back to school with, and the kids, and how harsh it was growing up, it wasn't a very good time. I kind of dreaded it. And on top of that, my father tried to push Methodists on us too. So I had my understanding of religion is very, very cruel and harsh. When I came into NA, I didn't think about religion. I already had a God in my understanding because, when I went in the military at 18, and that's when my drug addiction really took off. It had to be God with me to carry me through that and bring me back home, because I was actually waiting 14 years, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, for a cardinal knowledge statutory rape, and I just turned 19. And at my age, high yellow, I wasn't going to prison. I was either going to be dead or I was going to be somebody's bitch, one way or the other. So that scared the hell out of me, too. And I didn't want to come back home because of the life that I was raised to. You know, as a Jehovah's Witness, you know, everything was for the paradise on earth afterwards. And I didn't see no paradise where I was living. I had no idea there was a paradise that I could live in. You know, and my mom, still to this day, love her to death. She still preaches to me on constantly. And I try to throw my knowledge of recovery and the God of my understanding into it. Because here I find freedom. I find freedom from all of that. You know, I don't have to worry about getting struck down by lightning. I don't have to worry about today going to hell. You know, for the stuff that I've done. And for me, my past haunts me and on a daily basis. That's what actually, the self-centeredness, it just eats me alive a lot of times, a lot of days, a lot of cases. And I stay up in my head about it. Because like I said before, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy to stand up here. I'm very humble to be here. When Troy asked me a few weeks ago if I'd speak, I was taken back, you know, and I wanted to say no, but I have hardly ever turned down a service commitment when asked to do so. My sponsor says I've got a lot of information, and he's getting to know me better now than I got to know myself in this time, you know, and there's something else I need to get honest and get true and get clean and get free of in here, is because I've been around for almost 19 years and I've been through two marriages. I substituted relationships for recovery, food, sex, TV, sports, you name it. You know, I've got a hard head, very hard head, and I beat that wall from time to time. And I started working the steps with a sponsor back in the you know, 95. And I got in a relationship, actually my first day clean, with the mother of my son. And by the grace of God, he graduates this year. He's 17. He's doing a little boxing thing now, and trying to make some money or something, whatever. I gotta let him follow his dreams though. So, I got married in recovery to this woman. God forbid it wasn't supposed to be. I wasn't ready for her. She wasn't ready for me. I know I wasn't ready. And at 30 at that time, I thought I was. You know, it was God. You know, the second time around was the same thing. Oh, this must be God. You know, it really came down to it. I was really taking my will back, and I was looking for that, what do you call it, that great American dream, that house, two cars, you know, wife, kids, doggies, white picket fence. You see, I'm a sort of a family guy. I mean, I grew up, my mom and dad, although he cussed and hollered and abused us, either verbally or physically, in one form or the other, he went to work. I mean, he changed a lot of jobs, but he went to work. When he got the ass of somebody, he cussed him out and quit. Mom always worked, so the money was always there. As a young boy, I started working at 9 years old, bagging ice at a country store, you know, and so work hasn't been a problem for me. You know, I have that responsibility, that ability to, actually in my recovery, I've only been without a job for 30 days, and I did some things to leave the job. You know, I took some time off. And somebody offered me, by the grace of God, somebody offered me another job, and I jumped in and took it and ran with it, you know. So I've been blessed. I've been blessed to have that opportunity, you know. And so when it comes down to it, I've never had a problem with being a part of that, having a life and a family. And when we went to church and we got married and all that kind of stuff, it was, you know, that, you know, you're married. It's a, a religious institution, a spiritual institution, and all that. Okay, here we go with the religion thing again. Needless to say, neither one of them worked out because I didn't have a God of my understanding. I didn't allow a God of my understanding to work in my life. You know, and when it came time to do what I needed to do for Tony, guess where I had to come back to? The program in Narcotics Anonymous. So I said that my recovery stopped. I stopped working the steps. I stopped going to meetings. You know, several different times throughout the years, I hadn't gone to a meeting for up to 4 or 5 years. Last marriage stopped the same way, maybe about 2 or 3 years. That changed everything. My perspective on everything changed. But by grace of God, I was able to come back to the rooms, and that was almost heaven area. When I came in, after it fell apart in the fetal position, crying like a little baby, you know, because my heart was broken. I had failed again. You know, I didn't add up again. You know, my mother stuck by my father for 40 years through the abuse. You know, she was subservient. And I always told myself, man, I'd love to have a woman like that. you know, that would look after me. You're not having it down that. And that's okay. I've come recently to realize that I don't need to find that. When the God of my understanding is ready for me to have that, he'll give that to me. And I truly believe that. Actually, I run more now than I ever did from those. I listen more now until I hear the stories. You know, because if we listen to each other, we can pretty much get what we need to get. I truly believe that because I have. So flash forward to the future. You know, I came into Narcotics Anonymous, and I started to unload all the stuff that was inside of me. I've always believed in my sponsors, and I've always heard is tell your story. So, you know, I can get kind of raw sometimes. I can come up in here and say that when I was out using, I tricked in order to get high. You know? Well, that didn't fit into the religious aspect of my life because, you know, I fought homosexuality. You know, my father used to say, I remember him saying that he'd line all the homosexuals up against the road and shoot us all. But when a family member came out of the closet, not me, because I'm not. It's all baseball, though, my sponsor always says. Came out of the closet. He embraced him like no other. And it really rocked me. It's like, man, what the hell did I do wrong? You know? I used because the only thing that made me feel good was getting high. I could be anybody I wanted to be. Now, I grew up in the 80s when we had, you know, G.I. Joe. We had the $6 Million Man, you know. You know, I grew up on Clint Eastwood reruns, you know. So I was good, bad, and ugly all together. You know, we had Jim Brown, you know. Those were my idols. I always found a place to go inside of that. So when I started using, now granted, I didn't really start using until I went overseas in the Army. And from there, I learned how to do a whole slew of stuff. And that was my escape because I could be a fool, I could be a clown, I could be hard, I could be soft, I could be anything you wanted me to be to fit in. And I totally pushed God all the way out. But he never left me. He's always been there. When they told me, you can take a court martial, or you can get out with a chapter, well, you know the answer to that question. You know, and I left, and I came back, and I started working. And crack hit the scene back in the 80s. And I was in love. By the grace of God, I remember the first night, my first hit. And I wasn't just a single user of one type of thing. I like to take it all in. One is too many, a thousand never enough. All kinds. I mean, it wasn't one liquor. It was two different types of liquor. It wasn't one beer. It was all kinds of different. You know, because I was a sponge. And when you were around me, it was a party, so everybody could get high too. And a lot of people started using because of me, too. I got to make amends for that. But when I first started using, I collapsed. I think my heart stopped from the first hit. But I woke up. And so who was that? I woke up and would live to tell the tale. And proceeded on down that path because I took it for granted that I woke up. So I was able to, oh, damn, enjoy myself even more. You guys see that? See what happened to me? Yeah, we saw what happened to you. Nobody called the cops, though. Nobody called an ambulance. Like I say, I'm grateful to be here. Because he's been saving me for something. I'm raising a 17-year-old son. 2 years ago, he visited with his mom over the summer, and he learned how to use. Well, I already told him he's predisposed to addiction, the disease of addiction. I am. I got relatives, alcoholics, drug addicts, and everything else. You name it. Outside of the physical and mental illnesses, which eventually going to hit me too. And that really tried me because here we are again, the guy that doesn't believe in himself, that has low self-esteem, that is the worst thing walking on this planet, he's failing with his son because his son has used. And I couldn't stop it. They were in New Hampshire. I was freaking miles away. I couldn't be there. And it was probably damn good that I wasn't there, because I probably would have caught a charge. I probably would have been locked up. How dare you take the one boy, the one saving grace that I've had. See, the God of my understanding has a very crazy sense of humor, because she wasn't supposed to get pregnant. I was in the doctor's office because I'm the family guy. I was there for every maternity visit. I was there for every doctor visit. And I heard him say, she can't carry it. She can't even conceive a child. And when she got pregnant, I was like, whoa. And then God saw fit to grant me custody, full custody, when he was 2 years old. So, granted, you know who I've been married to for all those years. Him. And I never thought in my wildest dreams that I'd be able to do it. See, I stopped being that guy that almost went to prison. I stopped being that guy that needed something to escape from reality. I started to face reality. I started to walk this walk. I started to take some suggestions. And although, like I said before, I beat my head against the wall and I fight this thing tooth and nail, because where I come from, we do everything for ourselves. I don't need anybody in my life, you know. My sponsor helped me realize that recently, that, you know, I'm full of shit. He says it's a safety mechanism. See, if I do everything to myself, for myself, I don't have to let nobody in. I don't have to rely on anybody. I don't have to feel the pain, because I don't like to hurt. Yeah, I don't like to hurt. I don't like to feel the pain. Well, guess what? Stop doing shit that's going to make you hurt. Work the steps. Get a sponsor. Go to meetings. Keep it simple, stupid. Keep coming back. I mean, it is a real simple program for a very complicated person. And I'm talking about me. I don't talk about anybody else, because I don't know anything about anybody else. I just talk about me because I know about me. And I'm getting to know a little bit more about me. As this process goes, the religious aspect, I've done church. I've been back and forth to church, you know. I felt uncomfortable in church, in religion, and all the stuff that, and I like history, so I kind of educate myself in reading a few things, and, you know, it scares the hell out of me. I'm not scared when I come in here. I'm scared of getting up here talking to you all and getting gut-wrenching honest about myself and peeling some stuff off. I can't do that. I couldn't do that when I went to church. I couldn't do that in religion, how you call it, a civilized religion. Couldn't do it. It's not an avenue for me. What I've learned is I've had to accept the fact that it's not because of what my mother tried to push down my throat with the religion. It's because, really, it's just not where I need to be. I need to be right here with you all, right here, trying to carry the message to the newcomer, to let them know that if a dope fiend like myself can do it, you can do it. This convention is an example. And when I went to my first convention, I was stoked. Oh, my goodness. It's nice to be in like in Frederick, they have this thing called a Dope Fiend Olympics, where you got everybody come around and all the addicts get together and try to control shit and be stupid, you know, and have a ball doing it, you know. But to come to a convention and get hugs, I ain't got a problem hugging nobody. You know, I told you about my history with tricking. So, I mean, be who you are. Don't bother me. I'm totally secure with my manhood. And I like to hug. The only thing I don't have a problem with hugging is all the cologne that people have on. Because I put mine on, and it's gone. You know? But I still, nevertheless, you know, I'd rather be able to hug somebody smelling good than hug somebody funky as hell from being out for weeks and weeks on end. Or me, for that matter. Like I said, I'm truly grateful for this program. The spirituality of this program is just as a diversity. Nobody in here has the right way of doing this thing. There's so many different faces, nationalities, race, creed, color, everything in here. You can find what you want in here if you're willing to do what you need to do. And I was reading this morning about spiritual principles and reading about certain things and trying to relate that stuff to my life of having open-mindedness, having the willingness, having the humility, being able to forgive and understand. And where it begins is, it begins with me. It begins with me. Only by allowing the God of my understanding into my life to help me with understanding and accepting me can I give something back. And isn't that the whole purpose for us being here? Well, it is for me anyway. Because I need to give something back. See, every day that I get clean, every day that I wake up on this planet, every day I wake up above ground and I'm healthy, I have a job. I don't have a lot of things. I don't need a lot of things. You know, I just need to be able to eat, take care of my son, and give something back and try to be a part of something that's bigger than what goes on inside of Tony's head. And for that, I'm truly grateful. It's really simple. It's really simple. And even though I went out to my car after I ate my lunch, and I sat out there, and you know how you get set in the car after eating, and I fell asleep, and I was out for like an hour. And at my age, you can fall asleep on a dime. I'm telling you. Some of y'all know what I'm talking about. And I was so calm, and I woke up, and I was like, and my heart was racing. I'm like, I'm getting closer to this time, getting closer to this time. And I sat there, and I said the third step prayer to myself. God, take my will in my life and guide me in my recovery. My sponsor said yesterday, he said, just share your story. You know, what you're feeling is you got to get honest. And that's truly what I have to do. So I guess I've said enough. Once again, I'm humble. I'm grateful. Thanks for letting me share.
Hey, let's thank Tony again for a great meeting. And speaking on the PMS of the program, physical, mental, spiritual, is Jennifer T. from the Susquehanna area.
Hello, my people. My name is Jennifer. I'm an addict. Hey. PMS, I love that. That's really funny. I have a bad case of PMS. The physical, mental, and spiritual aspects of the disease. This topic, man, must have been picked just for me because I'm always talking about these three aspects when I share. And I want to thank the convention committee for asking me to speak. I want to thank the people who call themselves my friends who've come to support me because I am a social retard and this is a little overwhelming. I love the conventions and stuff, but man, I mean, you guys are wonderful. I love you guys so much. You know, the hug squad and the smiles and identification and knowing that you guys have the same thing that I do, it means a lot to me, you know, that we share the gift of desperation, the gut level pain of addiction. So there's a lot of joy here, but you know, it like comes at a cost of deep pain. Which is okay, you know. I'm glad I have this solution today. To give you guys a little bit of knowledge about me, I'm from the Susquehanna area, which is like Cecil County, Maryland. Rising sun, northeast, yeehaw. I got introduced to Narcotics Anonymous a long time ago when I got arrested. And, you know, I was like 16 or 17 years old, and I had been arrested a few times before, but this time they made me go to counselors. Counselors told me to go to meetings. They gave me a meeting schedule for the other fellowship. I went there. There's a lot of old guys sitting around talking about drinking, which I thought, hey, that's cool for you. And then one night, I think I was high, and I ended up in an AA meeting. And it was different, you know, from the get-go, the people that walked in the door, the hippies and the heads, and they were hugging each other and smiling and laughing, and I thought I was in some kind of religious cult meeting by mistake, you know. But I stayed because this really cute guy sat down next to me and started talking to me right away. So I stayed, and and I found it was a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, you know, and I was like, oh, man, that's cool for you. And and you guys said you weren't church, even though you said God a lot, but you passed the basket around, and that's the only place I ever seen a basket passed around was church, you know. But I stayed in the meetings. I went to meetings high sometimes. I went to meetings drunk. And the reason I bring this up is because the physical, mental, and spiritual aspect of the disease of addiction is a big part of like what we're doing here, recovering from. But I think it's important for me to share my experience about what misinterpretations of NA I had with me when I came here. And one of them was the name, you know, Narcotics Anonymous. And I've heard people say, hey, man, don't let the name fool you. We're not about crack or heroin or Suboxone or methadone. We're about recovery from the disease of addiction. And that disease takes many different faces and forms, whether you smoke it, shoot it, drink it, screw it, eat it, spend it, all that stuff. And the reason they didn't call it Addiction Anonymous was because the initials were already taken. Yeah, I thought that was a joke for the longest time, and I found out it's really true. We really didn't call it Addiction Anonymous because the initials were already taken. And so when I got here and it said Narcotics Anonymous, I was like, dude, man, I'm an equal opportunity, you know, user. I use everything. I use whatever you got, and I don't have enough time in the day to get all those fellowships, you know. So, but you people look cooler than those people, so I'll stick around here. You're cuter. And you know, and I went to meetings high, I went to meetings drunk sometimes. Nobody ever turned me away, and I sat in the back, and, you know, I just said, hey, man, that's cool for you. Because for me, drugs were not the problem, man. I really liked drugs. I really thought you guys didn't like getting high anymore. And we laughed because we all know we really like getting high. Really, really like it. I like it too much. But I thought that's what you guys were doing. I thought you guys were saying that if you just stop getting high, everything will be all right, man. Everything will come together, and your life will be rainbows and hot dogs and baseball games and kids and Mercedes-Benz and jobs at DuPont. And and I was like, nah, man, that ain't me. You know, like, I had been clean from time to time. Like, I could step away from it for, like, a day or two, you know? And nothing ever got better. It only got worse, you know, because I wasn't high, you know? So I thought I didn't belong here, you know, because I was like, I really still like getting high. And, you know, but I was coming because I don't know why. You know, I was supposed to, but I've been trying a lot of different things up to this point to try to straighten out my life. I come from a family of earth people. There's no other addicts in my family. You know, I got two older sisters and a mom and a dad, and they're dysfunctional in their own way, but they're not addicts, man. They drink socially. You know, they don't even smoke cigarettes. And before I ever picked up a drug, there was addictive antisocial things about me that made me stand out and made me feel very different. And like before I ever got high, my sisters had padlocks on their bedroom doors because I would break into their rooms to steal money, to buy pro wrestling magazines and candy. And I was like, my first real drug of choice was food. I was like one of the fattest kids in elementary school. I wouldn't clean the house. I wouldn't take a bath. I like to chase my older sisters around with steak knives just to see the look on their face. That's true. It's true. And I would tell dirty jokes to the preacher every now and then. And my family was horrified, mortified by me. And they were like, what is wrong with you? You know? What is wrong with you? And I remember at a young age being like, what? You know, this is fun. Why aren't you doing this too? And but then I remember, you know, looking at them and trying to tell them what I thought and what I felt. And they would look at me with this blank look on their face. Like they didn't understand what I was saying, and they were a little scared. You know? And so I learned from an early age, you don't tell people what, you know, is the truth because they don't understand. It freaks them out. You know, tell them what they want to hear. You know what they want to hear. And get out of that jackpot, you know? So I knew something was wrong with me, but I didn't think it was drugs. You know, around the age of 11, I didn't think it was addiction. Because it's not the drugs, you know? It is addiction. Because if it was a drug problem, all I would ever need would be a detox. Just one. And I would never go back. But I'm an addict, and I don't like being straight. Being straight is my problem, you know? We all feel the same when we're high. We're nodding out, feeling good. You know, just want the next one. It's what you feel when you're straight. that makes you an addict, you know? But anyway, I didn't know that then. So around the age of 11, I got my first high, which was from alcohol. And I remember that day, I can look back now because I've done some step work to see that that's the day I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than myself, which was that feeling. You guys been high. You know it. You love it, too, I imagine, because you're here. And you never forget. But I didn't know that's what I was consciously doing, but I can look back now and see that that's the day that, like, field hockey got dropped over, you know, from then on, and band got dropped, and this fat, square elementary school kid who really liked science got an identity of using, you know, partying. And over time, and that's all I wanted to do. That's all I knew how to do. Until I couldn't figure out what you'd do if you didn't party. I couldn't imagine a life if you didn't party. What the heck do? You know, in my mind, you sold Tupperware. You went bowling. You know, you watched Oprah. And I was like, no, ain't me. I'd rather die. And I was like, couldn't imagine it. You know, it just didn't fit. Yeah, but I knew something was wrong with me, man, and I would try to change, like, how I felt by changing my boyfriends or the drugs that I used. I only do this during the week and that on the weekend, and I'll meet with my mom, I'll meet with my dad, you know, I'll dress this way, da, da, da. And no matter all those things I did, I still felt the same inside, which was a sense of confusion, a sense that everybody else seemed to have, like, this book on how to live. And I didn't get the version, you know, because the stuff that I liked to do and wanted to do got me in a lot of trouble. And I really like getting high. You know, so I was coming out of NA, and I was trying different things to try to change my life. And, you know, stopping using was not really the answer for me, I didn't think. But I met a dude, right, that sat in front of the rooms with the NA meetings. And I guess he became my social lubricant into NA, you know, like, because when I came to NA, it was like, you guys all knew each other, and I felt like a big social retard, and just by hanging out with him and meeting his friends and stuff, and because that's what I would do, like, I'd meet a dude, and I'd pick up his dealers and his friends, you know, and this dude and that dude, and so I did it in NA, and going to meetings and stuff, I actually got 30 days clean. And I got into a state-run rehab, and in there, you know, I was like, I still didn't catch the message of Narcotics Anonymous. I still thought you guys were trying to get saved, trying to be good, or something like that. And I wasn't one of those special people. You know, like, I know the special people. They get hit by that lightning rod of God. You know what I mean? They just think of something, and they do it. Like, I remember going to church when I was using trying to get saved because I thought maybe that would be the key, you know, because I tried everything else. And, you know, it didn't work for me. I believe it works for people, the special people, and I'm not one of them. I think Narcotics Anonymous works for the non-special people. But there was a lot of things I wasn't willing to do because I was young, and I was like, man, there's too many drugs yet to be had. There's too many parties yet to go to, you know, but I'll try this out for a little bit. And I got, like, got out of that rehab, and, you know, I had to get a sponsor, and you guys told me it had to be a chick, so I had to get a chick, and I was not too happy about that. And I never called her, but I went to a lot of meetings, and I got involved with service, and I went through the motions, but I never worked the steps with anybody, and I wasn't really catching it still. I just thought it was about staying clean, you know, and then just staying clean. I didn't change inside. I still wanted to die, you know, so I got 4 months clean, and I used again. And I said, well, I tried that NA stuff, and it didn't work for me. But when I wasn't looking in the meetings, somebody must have planted a seed in my head. And with every drink and every toke, that seed grew into a bush I couldn't get away from. And if there's any other relapsers in here, they can probably tell you that once you've been here and you're going back out, man, your high is never innocent again. You know, you always got the voice in the back of your head telling you, what are you doing? You're killing yourself. Yeah. Right? And you got stuff that you guys said would come up at the weirdest of times. Like, I remember using and going up to Aramingo Avenue like 1,000 times before, and money's going, the drugs are going, thinking about things I got to do to get more. And, You know, remember you guys saying, man, this is a progressive disease. It always gets worse, never better. And the only ends for an addict is jail, mental institutions, and death. And that night I saw that, man, because the stuff that I was considering doing was stuff I said I would never, ever do. And I remember when I first got drunk with my cousin out in the cornfield, you know, we're smoking pot, and I remember having like a line in the sand then that said, I would never snort anything, and if you snort stuff, I don't want to hang out with you because you're going to steal everybody's stuff. And I had like my soapbox, and I would be nah, nah, nah. And the first time it got offered to me for free, you know, I did it. I loved it. And the line in the sand grew to like trips, you know. Never do trips. If you do trips, I don't want to hang out with you because you're going to flip out and you're going to have flipper babies. And all kinds of stuff's going to happen to you, you know. And the first time it was offered to me for free, you know, I was like, well, you got to have an educated opinion. And I did it and I loved it. And the line in the sand grew to, you know, you never shoot up. My God, I hate needles. That's terrible. First time it was offered to me for free, I'm like, you hit me. You know, no second thought about it. Just like, gotta do it, I'm gonna do it. You know, not that I just preached about it for all my life. And that's progression. And that night that I was going to, you know, I was thinking about things I said I would never, ever do. And then my lines in the sand became like, I'm not gonna spend the rest of my life in jail for it. I'm not gonna go to the mental institution for this. I'm not going to kill myself over this. And I realized that there's my lines in the sand, man. Jail, mental institutions, and death. And everything I did and everyone I hung out with and every drug that I had, every idea that I could come up with kept bringing me up to those same three lines in the sand, which is the ultimate end for an addict. It's like a magnet, man. It just takes us back. And we get back there and we get back there. And that was me. And I realized it that night. It wasn't somebody else trying to tell me that was going to happen to me. I saw it for myself. Something happens to you when you see death in the mirror. Looking back at you, and I'm slicing my arms, right? I'm just killing myself. I don't know why. I just know this is what I need to do. This is what I want to do, and I don't know why. And if you ask me too many questions, I'm going to turn around and blame you for it, you know? But anyway, I didn't stop using that night. It was like a few nights later, weeks, I don't know. And, you know, at the end of my addiction, I used a lot by myself in my bedroom, and you know, I'd cry a lot, and I would sit at this dresser and look in this mirror, and I would cry, and if you walked in on me, I would have said I wasn't crying, and I wasn't saying anything, but if I was saying something, it probably would have been like, I hate you, looking in the mirror and saying, this fucking sucks, fuck this, man, you know, I was too afraid to live, go out my door and look in the face of my family that still was looking at me like, what is wrong with you? And I had still no answer. And I was afraid to die because I didn't want to die, man. So I was in this hopeless state. And there on the nightstand one night that I was doing that boo-hoo and crying was a basic text. And I read that thing 100 times before in rehabs and meetings and all that stuff. And for the first time ever, I read the black part, the words. That's the best way I can explain it, man, because I don't know what happened before. Like, was I reading a different language or in between the lines I was going to get saved by the special people? I don't know, but I read Who is an Addict? And in that chapter, it was like I was standing in front of a mirror naked without any more defenses and blames and all that stuff. And I was looking in the mirror at my own reflection and saw the piece of shit that's looking back at me. And everything I saw there was written down in Who is an Addict? The stuff I wouldn't tell you, the stuff that I could hardly tell myself, is all written right there, and that freaked me out. And I read step one, and in there, because it's all really relates to the PMS thing. In step one, it talks about the results of the disease of addiction. And it talked about the results of the disease of addiction, not track marks or selling your butt and losing your kids and being homeless. And what you're using, how much you're using. The results of addiction are isolation, degradation, loss of control, distrust of others, embarrassment, guilt, and shame, remorse. That is me, and that's who I was. That's all that I was behind my happy hippie mask. That's all that I felt, man. If I felt anything, it was that, and I felt that clean. Not using. I felt that clean, which is why I used, you know? And it says, if you feel like this, normal people don't live like this, man. Normal people don't go holed up in their house, you know, hating themselves, regretting their past. afraid of life. But if you do, chances are you may be an addict. And if you're an addict, we have found this way out, man, from the pain that maybe most of us have felt all of our lives. And we find a new way to live through these steps, man. That freaked me out. It scared me, right? I'm like, man, this is what I've been looking for all my life. And it says at the end of step one, it says, this can be frightening. You can read it later when you get out of here. But it is the foundation on which we build our new lives is that I'm an addict. And I am an addict. So I went back to the meetings and I did Narcotics Anonymous. Not Jennifer's Anonymous. I got that chick to be my sponsor. This time I called her and I worked the steps with her. And that was not comfortable. And if you wait for stuff like that to become comfortable, you will wait too long. What feels comfortable to us is to use, man, until we die, go to a mental institution, or go to jail. We got to take risks and do what feels uncomfortable. Just listen to suggestions. I've been here ever since, 23 years. And let me tell you, I've cheated my fate every day that I'm here. I've cheated my fate with you guys. You've saved me a day at a time. But let me go back to the first step. All right, so my sponsor at the time, you know, she meets with me. She gives me this 17 questions in a spiral notebook. And she said, answer these to the best of your ability. I'll give you 30 days to do it. Don't call me every day, she said. I won't hear your shit. You're sick. Go to a meeting. Go to a meeting and get a support group. You know? I'm like, all right. And so I take it home, right? Now, I've been through rehab. I've been to meetings. And I swear, something, it doesn't work until you do it the Narcotics Anonymous way. This is my experience. I don't know why. I don't know why this stuff works. I'm just so grateful that it does. And if you can relate to my pain, then maybe you can relate to my recovery by doing just what I'm doing, which somebody else did. So anyway, in this first step, it says there are three aspects of the disease of addiction. You got to say how you're powerless over each aspect in order to say you are an addict. Not that you were just, oh, I happen to be chemically addicted to opiates. No, it's the three aspects of the disease of addiction. And how are you powerless over each? It's physical, mental, and spiritual. The physical aspect of the disease of addiction is once I pick up the first one for that day, I am obliterated. There's no social using for me 95% of the time. Can you catch me with that? Like, but I thought I had power because I would change my own mind. I thought people who were powerless over addiction couldn't control anything, right? Shit. And, all right, so because I would change my mind, I had power. Like, I'd start off saying, I'm only going to drink two tonight. And then I would change my mind and be like, you know, but I really want some of that. And, you know, that's okay, too. And then, you know, at the end of the night, I'm selling all my stuff for another hit again. Physical aspect. The mental aspect of the disease of addiction is that I'll do anything. When I'm using, I will use despite all negative known consequences. Whether I'm going to go to jail, my man said he'll leave me, I will get kicked out. And I will use anyway. In my insanity, I will think to myself, I won't get caught, or I'll deal with it later. Normal people don't make those kinds of decisions. We do. I do. That's the mental aspect. Most of that is arrested if you just follow the suggestions by going to meetings, replacing your own people, places, and things, and not getting high. Spiritual aspect is disease of addiction. It's my total self-centeredness. Not to be confused with selfishness. That's not what we're saying. Although selfishness can be indeed a result of self-centeredness. Self-centeredness is the state of my thinking, the state of my head that I'm powerless over. I'm reliving past experiences over and over today and feeling them as if they just happened. And I'm thinking about it. It could be 10 years ago, 20 years ago, yesterday, 5 minutes ago. And I'm rethinking it and rethinking it. And then I'm thinking about the future. I'm analyzing it 17 ways from Sunday and being prepared for each possible aspect. And they're never good. They're never good. So I got to be prepared, you know, which leads to my dishonesty. My self-centered mind is I'm thinking about what you're thinking and I'm thinking that you're thinking about me. And I know what you're thinking about me. You bitch. It's never good. And that's what makes me want to suck a gun at night, because I can't shut it off. The disease of addiction's between our ears. How do you know you're self-centered? You can see it in your life. You're isolated. You don't trust people. You're losing control. Embarrassed. Self-hate. They go hand in hand. The solution is the steps. And that's a whole nother convention meeting, right? But we start off with surrender. Surrendering to the program. Following suggestions. Practicing spiritual principles. Not religious ones, but spiritual ones. They are unconditional love, trust, hope, faith, compassion, courage, humility, honesty. The steps teach me how to not just know what those words mean, but how to speak them in my speech and how to do them in my life, in action. And when I can do that, when I practice spiritual principles, my life becomes spiritual. Spiritual living is better than any drug I've ever been on, including mushrooms, I swear. Kid you not. So although we're all walking around this weekend as social retards, look at each other like that and know that's what we all feel, the same thing. That's what makes us one of a kind. It's not the drugs you used, it's how we feel. Remember that you are not alone. Together we do this, you know? Thanks for letting me share. Have a great time.
All right. Hey, let's thank Jennifer and Tony for a great workshop.